This is Scott Woods from rockcritics.com. It's January 11th, 2010, and this is episode 7 of my conversation with Bob Dobbs. Bob, it's been a while. How are you doing?
Yes, I'm okay. Happy New Year, and I hope we haven't had too much of a gap. Let's try to get tuned into the January of the new decade.
Okay, good. Well, I wanted to dive right in. I've got one sort of broad topic that I'm thinking of this week, and a couple of quotes I'll throw at you. It's basically the topic is noise, something that rock critics like to go off about quite frequently, and I want to sort of discuss the relevance of noise among other things. But I'm going to start with there's two actually very recent books out at the moment by somewhat rock critics. One is called The Rest Is Noise, Listening to the 20th Century. That's by a guy named Alex Ross, and he's, I believe, a New Yorker. And then there's a British book by a guy named David Stubbs called Fear of Music, Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. And so both of these books, I haven't read the Stubbs, I have read most of the Alex Ross book, but both of them obviously deal with early 20th century, modernist composers of the Stockhausen, Schoenberg, Stravinsky lineage. And I guess the question I want to ask you is sort of taking off from the subtitle of the David Stubbs book, the Why People Get Rothko But Don't Get Stockhausen. So I guess let's just look at that. Why are painters, for instance, like Picasso or Kandinsky or Rothko, why do you think they're retroactively hailed as geniuses for altering perceptions through their visual art with works that were at the time, I think, considered extremely difficult or even violent to the senses, while the mass audience or mass ears still have a really difficult time tuning into music by people like Schoenberg and, Edgar Varèse. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his last name right, Varèse or Varese, and certainly Stockhausen. Why can we embrace difficult visual art much easier than we can difficult oral art?
I'm reminded of something McLuhan said in the late 60s about the Smothers Brothers show. They got canceled in 69 or so. And I think it was because of some comments on the Vietnam War. Not sure.
But that sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, and McLuhan wrote a letter to Playboy trying to explain it. He said, you can make jokes about sex now because sex is dead. But you can't make jokes about Vietnam because that's a living, iconic expression of the tensions of the present. And so I think of that in response to this, of what you brought up. And synchronistically, in my last show talking with Ben Watson, Ben out of the blue made this statement, and this was show number 34 if you want to look it up, in the Bob and Ben series. Ben says,
yeah.
Zappa turned the possibility of music into a criticism of how everything else was going. He had this window in the 60s when music was privileged. In the 20s and 30s, visual art was privileged. It was the thing. In the 60s, music was the thing. Then Ben says, at the moment, I don't know what is the thing, but I think we're on to it, meaning me and Ben. So I immediately jump in and say, it's tactility, Ben. Tactility is what it is. And that's ESP and the simulation of ESP. So my point is that people get Rothko now because the eye doesn't matter. But music does matter. Music is the drug for the global hologram. Remember, I've talked about music being a private concern. It's like music is the Vietnam. It's your identity so much. People need the drug of music to release themselves from the ground of tactile massage that's going on. And so therefore, the visual arts, which at the time Rothko was happening, wasn't popular. But we can review the history of visual art, and it's like water off the back of a duck. It doesn't mean anything anymore. It's the same syndrome as sex. It's dead. It doesn't matter what happens with it. It doesn't stress people people's identity. But people's identity is involved with the TV landscape and their TV body, which includes music. Music is really the core of it, and that's important. That's the Vietnam. So, but now music was the thing 40 years ago, almost 50 years ago. And Ben says, what is it now? And I say it's tactility. And tactility is this dancing to architecture and synesthesia that we've been talking about.
Right.
That is what releases people today. And so what is the ground of tactility? That's another level I would like to get to at some point. So when music, when electric orality came in with radio 80 years ago, then, as Ben says, in the 20s and 30s, visual art was privileged. Everybody was concerned about the quality of the eye and what decorated their walls or their culture mausoleums known as museums. This was important, what was happening to the eyes, everybody was fixated on. And when they're fixated on something, they're obsessed and have a need for it to balance some underlying tension. So when radio moved us into electric orality and jazz and music and all that came in with radio, people in the West, being visually conditioned, became obsessed with the eye. And so that would be their private concern, right? So... so that is why Ben is correct to cite the cliche that in the 20s and 30s, visual art was privileged. It was the thing. It was what people were neurotic about, okay? They just couldn't handle the changes that were happening to the eye, and those changes in the arts by Picasso and Lewis and everybody were symptoms of a change in the whole sensory ratios of the people. Okay, so then you come into the 60s, and Ben says music was the thing. That's because in the global hologram of the 60s, it was a tactile culture. That was the hidden ground, the extension of tactility. But the eye would not be something that would bounce off and give a release from tactile massage. It would have to be the ear. So the ear became the essence of private concern and the obsessive compulsive disorder, or both, the quality of music and what was happening to it. And so those that... that, like the new youth music, were irritating to the adults who were either hoping some interest in Varese or Boulez or the serious composers, or wanted to go back to the symphonies, and Leonard Bernstein would fill that gap, or they go to the Boston Pops. You have this issue. And so when you say people never got Stockhausen that, it's because music is more important to people's lives than visual art. That would be my broad explanation of why people now can understand Picasso, because the techniques of Picasso and the Surrealists and the Dadaists and everybody else brought in 80 years ago are normal fare in advertising by the 50s, or at least the 60s. So the eye is not an issue of concern. And so people can get it. It can claim they understand Picasso and Rothko. If they actually heard my explanation of why they were getting it and the details or issues of what the artists were saying, if you read their own criticism, their own critical theory, they wouldn't understand that. All right? Maybe a few educated people in the humanities would go into the fine arts departments or something. They would understand it. And you see them, when I was in New York, you saw these young people being experts on the history of art all over the place, and they were trying to get jobs in museums. So they would guide the tours through the Met and the Guggenheim, the Whitney and the Frick and all that, right? These young whippersnappers. And they toss it off, but, you know, as soon as they left the museum, they'd put their little earplugs in and be listening to music, right?
Right, right.
Anyways, these books are missing the larger effects. And this is consistent with my criticism that anybody doing musical theory or pop criticism, like these guys that got to the level of being an author and wrote these books, they're missing the big picture to explain it. I mean, it's a puny issue when you understand it in my terms. But what's interesting now is that in this decade, rock criticism has apparently transitioned, died, because music is not the thing anymore, the way it was in the 60s and 70s. What now is tactility. And what is tactility? It's virtual tactility, expressing yourself in many media. You're actually expressing your synesthetic sensibilities. And that is what holds people now. Just as music held people in the 60s and visual art held people in the 20s and 30s. Tactility is what's holding people. And it's hard to explain what tactility is, but the simple thing is mixed media. Everybody right. plays with mixed media, with all their sensibilities. And
the interplay of the senses you described it as.
Yeah, it's not a sense, it's the interplay. And Web 2.0 allowed everybody to express their synesthesia in their consumption habits and their web pages and MySpaces and YouTubes and all that, right? They were able to broadcast. Yeah. We're at an interesting situation now where that is faltering. People are now looking for something new. And what would that means the what was the ground when tactility was a figure over the last 15 years? Now, if we figure out what that ground is, what is it as figure? And what would be the ground for that? So I don't want to deal with that yet. I want to go back to this point that people, because music was a drug, it had to be sweet. And noise music, at least in the 50s, 60s, when serial music was trying to get attention and people complained, I mean, we know that Zappa, as a young man, had to deal with the kind of music he wrote. He was interested in the Webern and these people and wrote music like that, but he knew it wouldn't sell. But then how do you explain how irritating music or the Kraftwerk genre, the noise stuff, kind of becomes popular by the 90s, right?
Right.
But see, that's a different generation. And here's the key to that. What is tactile music? It's noise. Because tactility is the noise, the interplay of everything, but not anything in particular. Therefore, it's a blur. Acoustically, that would be noise. And so, and Ben Watson just wrote an article for a noise collection. Did you see that? Did you see the article I sent around? Ben, he reviewed the book of all these guys writing about noise, and he didn't like the trendiness of noise. But Ben doesn't like the trendiness, but he never knows. He just feels it. He's got the right pulse. He knows there's something amiss here. It's not really a useful anti-environment anymore, noise as
right,
entertainment.
Right.
And he can't figure out what it is, but I always come in with a larger framework and an explanation that fascinates him, because even though he may not totally understand it, he says, well, at least Bob has some, he can pretend to have an explanation about this. And it's systematic once you follow what I'm doing. And when Ben went through this cycle, it was such a present, a gift for me, because to point out that the eye was privileged in the 30s and the ear was privileged in the 60s, what is privileged now? Tactility. And noise is the tactile. It is the tactile ear. Just like abstract art was the tactile eye. It was a noisy eye that art moved into with Rothko and them. They had their theories and their mathematics and their aestheticism of colors. You know, the Barnett, Newman, and these guys would float. But still, it was pretty chaotic looking, pretty noisy for the eye when people saw that art in the 50s and 60s. Just think of Jackson Pollock. So noise takes over as an expression of 20 years after the music is a thing in the 60s. What's next? Tactility. And you can start to track it in the 80s and 90s with the youth culture getting into craft work, into the noise. That's the tactile ear. So that's my my immediate response to that.
Okay. I'm confused by the tactile ear, but that's...
Okay, here's a quote from McLuhan that might help. Darkness is to space what silence is to sound, i.e. the interval. So silence
right.
is the interval in the sound world.
So everything is noise, and the interval is...
The interval is tactility. No, you have to understand the... So when he says darkness, and he said this in the 60s, darkness is to space, that's like visual space, lit space.
Yeah.
Darkness is to space what silence is to sound. They are both the interval or the tactile. See, the interval is not anything in particular. It's the space between things, or it's...
Right.
Do you see what I'm saying? So another word for tactility is the interval. And so darkness and silence are tactile, but silence is, as McLuhan would quote John Cage, all sounds happening at once. So another version of that is noise. What was the Velvet Underground thing? White noise?
Right, right. Well, white light, white heat, yeah.
Yeah. So white noise is another expression of the tactile interval. And does that clarify anything?
I think so. Okay, so, I mean, noise, okay, I guess I'm talking a little bit, though, about quote-unquote noise. Noise as, a genre, almost. I mean, you were talking about the book.
Yeah, as an aesthetic preference.
Right, as an aesthetic. So, noise itself, I mean, for many, many years now has, you know, been so assimilated into pop music, I guess. Like, and you know, even stuff on the radio. I mean, you turn on, you know, an R&B or hip-hop station, and you will hear some, like, jarring sounds that, you know, 30, 40 years ago would not have been considered part of, certainly not part of pop music.
Right.
Like, you can hear stuff that's going on in hip-hop that, you know, it might sound almost as radical, like, to some people now as Stockhausen would have sounded 40 years ago or something. But it's more like it's been assimilated, I guess. It's not the thing in and of itself. But
this is ammunition to prove my point. But go ahead. Is there anything such, what were you going to say?
Well, is there such a thing as noise in and of itself, I guess, is what I'm ultimately asking. Like, does noise actually exist anymore? Or is because it's all noise, you know, there's no such thing. I mean, it doesn't sound like noise. Like, what function can a quote-unquote noise actually serve?
Well, if we live in a post-information society, which is what I claim, and information is, you know, visual, acoustic, proprioceptive, tactile, smell, kinetic input or stimulation, if we are so numb, then none of that registers because it's limited to the chemical body. And as we moved into the TV body, the chip body, the closest the chemical body could come to that would be the tactile interval. And for the ear, that would be noise. That's like a Pollock painting. That's noise for the eye. So when you think of the tactile interval and synesthesia as a blur, either visually or acoustically, that is really not what tactile is. That's the closest you can visualize it or express it, but it's not. So over the last 20 years, the abrupt sounds, the abrupt noises that comes into pop music is more and more injecting of stimulus in a pop, in a chemical body, in a chemical ear that's dead, that's numb, and is not. You see, it's very interesting how people live today. I mean, a friend of mine was telling me their son does something like 13,000 text messages a month. Okay? 13,000. Some huge number like that.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you could call that
a day or something.
Yeah. That is moving his thumbs, I'm assuming, and it is visual noise. It's alphabetic noise that's going back and forth. But it's not acoustic noise, it's visual noise. Texting is noise, and it's a phatic, phatic, noise.
Yeah.
The thing is that we can't register what's going on in people's multi-bodies now, and therefore the extremes of the chemical body experience are the closest to approximate communication with the sensibilities of the TV body and chip body, and that'd be why all the experiments of Rez and the noise guys of the first half of the 20th century are nothing compared to what people do and put in pop music.
Like, wait, say that again, Bob. Go back just a bit. What was that last sentence?
All the experiments of Rez and the ones who laid down the noise aesthetic were bringing in the sounds of the environment that Cage was like the PR poster child for.
Yeah.
That stuff is so puny compared to the sounds that the average kids make in their hip-hop records or whatever, wherever they do it, their websites, their MySpace. They make collages. It's the closest you can come to stimulating the TV ear and the chip body ear is to have some blatant, extreme attack. And you can call it noise. So the aesthetic of noise is faded out. And so when Ben says, at the moment, I don't know what is the thing, but I think we're on to it, and I'm telling Ben it's tactility, I would have said that 20 years ago. Tactility was the next area of private concern, and we are past that. Because you can't describe the sensibilities of where we are for the kid who doesn't care, is not stimulated by the noise anymore.
Right.
So noise becomes sweet in the pop music, in the pop market.
Right.
You know that phrase, sweet.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting when I catch glimpses of what's going on in the pop culture and music. It is way beyond Zappa's Lumpy Gravy. It's very inventive. It's just mass hallucination and it's like someone said that by the early 90s, as TV became obsolete, it would have to take its clothes off. Well, music industry had to do the same thing. They had to market any kind of sound. And actually, the weirder or more esoteric or strange, the better. But they felt they put the sweetness in there too, right?
Right.
A little bit of sweetness, but the whole range of high, low, ugly, beautiful, all constantly as a daily diet for the chemical body ear. And that is the figure, and it isn't releasing people. That's why music, you know, the music industry in a lot of ways died. Now music is dancing with architecture on your website, expressing yourself.
Okay.
And not being concerned about actually which data you use. It's the act of typing is the thing now. So in the 60s, music was the thing, and then Ben says, I don't know what the thing is, but I think we're on to it. It's not, I don't know why Ben thinks he and I are on to it, but Ben has to recognize that tactility was the aesthetic preference in the 90s, and now it's just typing, which is like tactile, use your fingers, but it's more than that. It's like producing your own universe. Is the thing now, and that releases you from the mystery landscape that we've moved into. So again, I brought way beyond the rock critic zone, but we do have to deal with the fact that rock criticism disappeared.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So noise is easier to appreciate or
noise is not noise
because it's not noise.
Yeah, there was somebody once said in a McLuhan seminar, how can you do theater if we live in a global theater? Everything is already theater inside the satellite, so what happens to the institution or genre of cultural activity called theater? Well, when everything is when everybody's deaf or the chemical body is deaf because you're now using your chip body ears, then what is the role of sound or music? How could it be when everything is already... What's the role of noise when everybody is already deaf? So you'd have to get close to extreme noise to prompt the deaf. In other words, I'm saying that the most extreme situation is where we arrived at. That's what Baudrillard said he was doing, describing extreme phenomena. We're in a very extreme situation. And so these guys who write these books about why are people getting Picasso and not Stockhausen?
Yeah.
Those writers are concerned about the chemical body ear. And that died 30 years ago. That's what's sort of irrelevant about that theory. About the concern.
But there's still some truth to that, though. If you take that question on its face, and you still say that's a chemical body thing, but
yeah.
If you take that question on its face, I mean, it's the fact of the matter is, if I were to play, 10 people in a room, if I put on some Stockhausen at a party, unless it was a very arty New York crowd or something, most people would still say, take, you know, take that shit off or something. If I try to DJ a wedding and put on Stockhausen, it just, you know, it'd be more.
Okay, so you have to look at the nature of the audiences and which one you're dealing with, but
right.
a big part of the people today is they got no attention span. Stockhausen's trying to make a point with noise. And that's irritating. He's going to make almost a theoretical, linear, humanistic statement with the noise. And who's got the 20 minutes to listen to it? Nobody. But we can get little, you know, little increments of sound in a two-minute song when it weaves in and out every 5 seconds or something.
Right, when it's assimilated.
Yeah, you're asking, when people, if you DJ Stockhausen, you're asking people to listen to music. That's not what music is for. Once you have a wedding or a DJ environment, music is a supplement to the dancing, or to the drinking, or the conversation, or the flirting, or the drug taking.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah.
It is not. It's almost
you're
like
not playing so people will sit there and listen.
Yeah, you can, and that's a visual perspective. Sitting in a chair and listening. That's why the symphonies went dead, why concert going died, and the only way people would go to a concert if some bizarre thing was happening. Like Living Theater in the late 60s, they forced the audience to come up and take their clothes off. That was the last gasp of theater.
Right.
Right? You had to create an happening, a scene. And now music is not a issue of private concern. It's not an issue anymore of private concern. And that's part why rock criticism would die, because rock critic was the arbiter, the curators of the Museum of Acoustic Consumption for an audience that was concerned about music. Now, you're going to get the odd... Now, what's interesting, you've got a lot of immigrants coming into North America from third world cultures and less virtualized cultures, at least over the last 20 years. Those people, those kids are going to prop up all the old arts because that's still relevant to them. Their sensibilities have not been mutated, like the kids who grew up here and whose parents grew up here. You follow what I'm saying here?
Yeah.
I mean, who are the popular singers today? Aren't they people with non-waspish names in teen music?
Well, I mean, I think it's a huge vat of different type of...
Yeah, you can't even have a standard. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Britney Spears. There always seems to be some wasp that...
Yeah, there's Britney Spears and Lady Gaga. Although even Lady Gaga is like Italian-American, whatever. But yeah,
right.
No, I know what you're saying, yeah.
But I'm saying...
No, you've always... Like in the last... Here's an example. Like in the last 10, 15 years in particular, there's definitely been a sort of an explosion, for instance, of Latin music in pop music.
Right, and the point is that the audience for the archetypes of the American Hollywood entertainment complex
yep.
is charismatic for those people who didn't experience the last 30 years and are just experiencing now as immigrants. They want to have the American hologram. So that's another factor. I mean, what are wealthy kids or WASP suburban kids today whose parents were boomers and grew up in America or Canada, and then their parents did that and goes back, you know, 100 years or something, what are they into? They're into going to college and getting drunk.
Yeah.
Do you know about that phenomenon? That all universities now, they 60 Minutes, a friend told me about this, I didn't see it. They did a special on it recently. And the kids, it's normal to go for 5 days drunk. That's what you do in university now. Now, that's exploring your numbness. You know what I mean? It's aesthetically, it's like Jackass stuff.
Yeah.
It's reverse Jackass stuff. That is what is meaningful to people who are not immigrants, to people who aren't immigrants and are not trying to fit in. They already run this place. You know, remember in the movie The Good Shepherd, did you see that?
No, I didn't see that.
Well, the mafia guy is talking to the James Jesus Angleton guy, and he says, you know, the blacks have their music, the Irish have their something, and us Italians, we have the church. What have you guys got? He says to the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant James Jesus Angleton guy, right, the head of the CIA, or head of covert intelligence, and he says, "We have the USI. We have the USA. You're all just visitors." Okay, that mentality, which is what you call the class system or the racism and all that, that's still there in the upper white sections, right?
Right.
And so what are they doing? They got nowhere to go. So they blast themselves and get drunk for 5 days. That's their private concern, to explore their proprioceptive sense, their balance. They're exploring proprioceptive balance. Now, Scott, I'm getting an insight here. I like it when I get an insight. I've got a new pattern here. Like, Jackass has explored the chemical body's proprioception by just pushing it to extreme and hurting it, and upsetting their pain threshold or whatever, all that extreme, and bungee jumping and all that. Okay.
Yeah.
Now that the chemical body is so removed, people now blast their TV body scenario, and that's proprioceptive haptic, close to tactile, but that's not a sense. So the closest is proprioceptive. So the drinking is blasting your chemical, your TV body's nervous system.
Okay, where's
music there? They have music on while they're doing it. Okay, another thing is, what are these kids doing? They're filming themselves and putting themselves on porn sites. You go to any porn site, there's all kinds of footage of college couples screwing, and they just put it out there on the web. So where's culture there? They're not concerned about music. They're exploring the most intimate physical processes. That's tactility. That's trying to get in touch with the most intimate part of your insides. Okay? And that's what proprioceptive is. That's the sense of balance and the sense of gauging how you feel inside, right?
Okay.
So, as a matter of fact, Eric McLuhan said that the Internet was, and he wrote this in the late 90s in his book called Electric Language, and he says the Internet is an extension of proprioception.
Huh.
So that would be the chip body, so the anti-environment to that is blowing up your chemical body's proprioception, like getting drunk. Now, do you realize, you know a bit about that fad that's happening now? That these kids...
I've never heard of that, no.
Yeah, I think it's some university in Pennsylvania, Penn State maybe, is the top drinking university. They go for weeks.
Wow.
Everybody just blasted out in the... I think my friend said that the alma mater people of Penn State, or some university around that area, they come to the games, the ones who've been students and now are businessmen or whatever, and functioning or stable citizens, they come to the parking lot outside the big stadium and meet with all the undergrads and the frat boys, and they have a colossal binge of drinking for a couple of days. No, I mean, just go back to the 100 years ago, how people, their sense of decency, they would not be allowed to do that. Okay, so you've got to bring in the four-body model to understand any of these issues of pop culture, and what's happening in music. That's the only way to look at this, because it's beyond, you know, these books you're writing about people worried about, is a 20-year-old is blasting themselves on alcohol, probably even takes art courses, fine art courses, and reads about Picasso and Duchamp and all that because they have to write papers on it. They don't take that seriously as part of their living involvement in the now. They got to blast themselves around the football game. So the worried about whether someone likes Stockhausen or not, you got to use sensory, cultural, multi-bodied reasons, not any aesthetic thing that those books probably use, right? You know what I mean? There ain't no art, there ain't nothing on that level anymore. As a matter of fact, the only people who are worried about art on that level are the millionaires and billionaires in New York City who have to go to the Met annual party, the Vogue thing they put on, you know, the... you remember the movie The Devil Wears Prada?
Right, yeah.
Okay, that was based on Anna Wintour, I think, the head of Vogue magazine. And the whole media swarmed around the big night when they went to the Metropolitan Museum and everybody was all decked out and this was important to be seen thing. That kind of, as McLuhan said, society becomes an art form. high society. And we just had one of them just died the other day, Casey Johnson. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, that's right. I did hear about that, yep.
Yeah, well, there's a, and this is part of my musical life. There is a site called New York Social Diary and another one called Park Avenue. So occasionally I'll go there and they'll show all these young billionaire daughters at their parties, at their charity balls, and charity this and charity that. So when I heard about Casey Johnson, only because I happened to look at TMZ and someone named Tequila Tila freaked out this weekend. I didn't know who it was. So I had to Google who the hell is this girl that they're harassing. And she was the lesbian lover of Casey Johnson, who had just died, right?
Right, right.
And so I said, oh, Casey Johnson. So let's see if I ever noticed her on this New York Social Diary. And I click on it, and I put in Casey Johnson. Sure enough, there comes up a couple of pictures, you know, recently where she was at the Met, Vogue, Anna Wintour, Devil Wears Prada scene with her buddies. And it's always the same top girls, and they're all from very wealthy families. They're the ones who go to the opera, go to the museums, and they're very concerned about culture because they have to prop up that whole meme, the Gutenberg Galaxy meme, that money is linked to. You know, art historians might call, art critics call it the commodification, but it's the commodification of the chemical body as an elite phenomenon. And so that made Casey Johnson, if she wasn't so addicted to whatever it was that she OD'd on, she might have been interested in that book because that's her world. This is what Robert Crisco and them don't know. They're writing for the elitists who care what goes on in the museum culture because they can afford to live in New York and have the time to go to all the benefits and go around and meet all the new artists and hang out with Moby or Damien Hirst or something. It's all for high society, this stuff. And the kids know it, so they just get blasted. The middle classes that are at universities blast themselves. And that's the new music. Is what I'm trying to get at. Getting drunk in the parking lot of a football game with your frat fathers.
Well, but that's not specifically new, though, really, is it? I mean,
the scale is big.
Well, the scale is bigger.
You could not.
These kids,
because it's a post-information society, there's no reason to go to university. You only go there for developing your social skills. And what is your social life? The ability to be drunk for 5 days and still be standing—that is, there's nothing to learn at college anymore.
It's like Animal House,
squared, cubed,
writ huge,
writ large. And so no wonder the rock critics are laid off. I mean, you can't even get people to read the New York Times anymore.
Yeah.
And so that is. Since pop culture has always been outrageous, you know, going back to Mae West, right?
Right.
It's always, you know, sticking it to the eye of the high society or of the bourgeois Puritans. That is really the role of pop culture, and it always shifts its ratios and sensibilities all through the last 100 years, and you have the Bend statement that the eye, being outrageous for the eye in the 2030s was important, and then for the ear in the 60s, and then to blasting tactility over the last 10, 15 years. I mean, that is what hip-hop is. Hip-hop and rap is a tactile non-music. We can call it music, but it's not limited to music. It's, you know, what's interesting is Zappa said he wasn't interested in rap when it first started happening because he said it was just people on a soapbox. It was political soapboxing.
Right.
He was probably thinking of Public Enemy, you know what I mean, 20 years ago.
Yeah, or maybe some of the early Grandmaster Flash, The Message, maybe, or something, yeah.
Yeah, okay. The point is, what Zappa missed was that, because Zappa was, his bugaboo, he was an advanced ear. He was an advanced chemical body ear, and he was concerned about that, but he recognized the virtual digital stuff that was changing, but he still was a specialist in the ear, and he misinterpreted Public Enemy as bringing in politics. It wasn't politics. When you can wear the whole world with Android mean technology, which people were starting to have by the 80s, where you could put on huge media environments and wear them just with cable TV, you're all over the place. You got 50 channels. Then you want to assert your space, and that's political. So politics, you see, what Public Enemy didn't realize that they weren't doing politics and they weren't doing black power. They were doing tactility. They didn't even know what it was. That's why it came and went.
Okay. Bob, this might or might not be relevant, but do you have the...
I'll tell you this, Scott. It is always relevant because, as McLuhan said when he wrote Understanding Media, I grab for anything. If you're in a tactile synesthetic, is like I say on the radio show, just say words.
Okay.
We can use it. So everything's relevant here.
Okay, good. So one of the articles I sent you, Chuck Eddy, it's called Obligatory Noise Interlude.
Okay, you want me to look that up?
Yeah, look that one up.
I have it.
The pages are numbered, and it would be the second page, which is page 244.
Yeah, I have it. Okay.
Okay, and the first new paragraph on that page reads as such, actually. And it was funny that you mentioned Public Enemy in that context, because I was going to read you this quote anyway. So this is Chuck Eddy talking about noise. Noise as sort of used in pop or rock music.
Yeah, he's actually complaining about the tactility that I'm talking about, isn't he? He's saying it's too normal, the noise, isn't he?
Yeah, he's saying that noise has become like a completely
harmless, doesn't serve as in any environment, which is a critic he would be looking for.
Yeah, I think that's what he's saying, basically. And yet there's this assumption that it still has the ability to upset, but he doesn't hear it that way or something.
Right, okay.
So he's writing, anyway, noise might be defined as any sound that jars you, that happens when you don't expect it. The one problem with noise rock, Sonic Youth, Ministry, Test Department, Tricky, Public Enemy, Slayer, for instance, is that you do expect it, so the noise doesn't generally work very well, though a few of those groups have been known to stumble onto moments that aren't completely wretched. Blah, blah, blah. Then Public Enemy's second best song, after Sophisticated Bitch, which is real sexist with loud guitars, is called Bring the Noise. Chuck D says they use noise, quote-unquote, to agitate, make the jam noticeable. So when a car passes by, you'll know it's pumping PE right away. So noise, quote-unquote again, serves as a uniform, Chuck has told Spin magazine. We wear it sometimes, and sometimes we don't.
Oh, that's a beautiful paragraph for what it shows. Chuck doesn't get it, but... I mean, who wrote this?
Well,
Chuck Eddy?
No. He gets it somewhat, doesn't he?
No, I'm saying this is Chuck Eddy, right?
Yeah, Chuck Eddy. Yeah.
Yeah. Chuck Eddy doesn't...
Chuck...
But Chuck of
Chuck
Public
D.
Enemy gets it.
Chuck D.
He doesn't understand why he says these things, but he's totally expressing my point. It serves as a uniform. Tactility is a figure. Serves as a uniform, as clothing, to get attention. That's all we want to do. We don't care what it does. We want to get noticed. And he says we wear it sometimes, and sometimes we don't. That's a very tactile situation. Tactility is on, off. Touch, not touch. Here, gone. Like the electron is in two places at the same time. Here and gone. He's being tactile. We wear it sometimes, sometimes we don't. And so where is the aesthetic value? There's no consistent point of view that he's sticking to. We do this, and we do that. We use this, we use that. You know what I mean? That's tactility.
Yep.
That's synesthesia. That's my point. So it's the ground of why Chuck D is doing this that is what the critics should point out. But here, because Chuck Eddy doesn't understand, you know, the larger, bigger ground relationships, he gets into an aesthetic preference for that kind of noise and this kind of noise. And he actually thinks noise could jar you. Probably rap was the last effort of noise jarring you. And they didn't include acoustic musical noise. They included being outrageous and being gangsters and being political and being racist. You know what I mean? They include that as part of their noise, not just the sound part. You get my point?
Right. But I think he's grappling a bit with that question. I mean, I think...
Yes, he is. I remember reading this article, you know, a month or two ago, and it's a good article. But these articles... always make me say, "Hey, Chuck, if you just knew me, I'd help you put this in order, you know, if you accepted some of my premises." But I would put this is again. These articles are just great evidence for my case. But my case is on a different level of framing than Chuck Eddy is.
Okay.
Do you get that?
Yeah.
Okay, so he goes, but noise. Okay, he disagrees with. He takes Chuck literally. Chuck says it serves as a uniform, and then Eddie says, but noise works best when it's not a uniform. He's falling back into 60s and 50s aesthetic choices, like those books you cited. He says, when it's just a byproduct of whatever else is happening in the music, he's trying to select and have preferences, and that's the foolishness of rock criticism. But in the course of writing it, he does provide me great evidence, and it's useful data for me. You know what I mean? I'm glad he wrote this article, even though what he has to say about it, any afterthoughts or perspective, I wouldn't give him the time of day. It's not relevant unless he was willing to engage in my terms, and then he could question my terms. But you got to deal with the given facts, which is the environmental situation I'm talking about, building on James Joyce, Wendell Lewis, and McLuhan.
Okay. But read his next sentence, though, in that same paragraph.
Okay. In rock and roll, that one?
Yeah.
In this happened, oh, let me just go back. But noise works best when it's not a uniform, when it's just a byproduct of whatever else is happening in the music. In rock and roll, this happened most often back before noise rock made noise an end in itself. You can go back to blues, vocal mumbling.
Just up to there, basically, then. Gives a bunch of examples of...
Well, let me just read them for the right. You can go back to blues vocal mumbling, to early holes in the speakers, / aluminum foil in the amps, feedback accidents by Link Wray and Ike Turner, to the drums in Louis Prima's Jump Jazz, Sing, 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 a humongous precursor of John Bonham's Big Boom in Led Zeppelin. By 59 to 61, feedback solos were working their way into pop hits like the Regent's Barbara Ann, Noisy Sax 2, the Del Vets' Last Time Around, and Dave Baby Cortez's Happy Organ. The thing is, that's when the ear was the figure and tactility was accidental. By the 90s, tactility is the figure, and it's a matter of concern, and people are conscious about it, or nerdy, or aesthetic. He wants to retrieve the spontaneity factor of tactility when it was happening in the 60s. But the whole ground has changed, and people are... Because tactility becomes the figure, there is a different ground. It's a post-information society, so tactility is a figure. Then everybody gets, obsessive-compulsive about it. And
I thought tactility was the ground.
In this review, Ben's pattern here, which is useful. In the 20s and 30s, the visual art is what everybody's bugged by because acoustic space, electrified acoustic space, is the ground, the radio era. When you get into television, which you can see as well as hear, and there's movement in it, it's more inclusive of all the senses. So television is tactile. So television is ground in the 60s. Tactile is the ground, so the figure is not the eye, the figure is the ear. Because the ear is closer to the sensory modality, instantaneity of tactility. The eye isn't. The eye is sequential. So the ear becomes the drug of choice to bounce off the real ground of tactility that's happening in the 60s. So then when you get into what I call the post-information society, the period of the Android meme, the Internet, and all this, where technology is communicating to itself and not even paying any attention to the chemical body, then tactility, which is the last gasp of the chemical body, it's ground itself. The ground of the chemical body is tactility. That's the central nervous system. It becomes figure. And the ground of that is what I'm always addressing. You see what I'm saying? So that's why I can understand Meltzer and all these people. They are describing tactility and don't know it. And Eddie's world is a later stage, the 90s, than Meltzer's 60s and 70s world. So yeah. Tactility is a figure, and you have a music critic, Chuck, an ear specialist, trying to put ear values on tactility as a figure, and he's just not going to get it. He's going to bring up things that are irrelevant. And this is about a phenomenon that's long gone. In a hyper-tactile environment as figure, everything ends up with Croker's quote. Page 53, which I may have said last week, last session. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know, this is all that you can know, and what you know is that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at,
right?
Because you have never really heard what you were listening to. Nobody's listening by the 90s. That's why you make the jam noticeable by putting as much irritating cultural signs in there as possible, including noise. And even that doesn't work. You're only in for a year or two, and then you're gone. Who remembers Public Enemy now? Or who's involved in it, right?
Yeah.
It's long gone.
Well, but there's new
no noisemakers. I used to look at the Village Voice every week, and once a month to be a reviewer of the latest hip hop guy, and it's amazing how many came and went.
Yeah.
I mean, they would have articles on the best of, and they'd be celebrating someone who was a big hip hop artist in New York or in that area, 3 years before. I never even heard of him, and he's already old hat, trying to make a comeback.
Right.
To have a perspective on it, you've got to come up with and come back to Croker's thing. Hey, I'm not hearing anything. Another way to say that is, this is not music made for me or anybody. It's music made for the scene, for the media, the Android meme itself. The Android meme requires noise for the ear of itself, and that's what all the music was for, all the noise was for. It needs movies.
So what are we doing when, and by we I mean just an audience in general, what are we doing when we think are we not responding to music?
That's right. We're not responding in any way that anybody did 50 or 100 years before.
Because
when we were a visually biased, print-oriented society, the ear was orgasmic, and it was an important event. And so classical music but that's the chemical body ear. We got four bodies now.
Yeah, I mean, you can even see that if I'm getting you correctly.
You're getting me.
Okay. Well, you can even see that progression even in the last 30 years with rock music, because in the 70s, I know growing up with an older brother, 7 years older than me, so he had even more of a connection to like the hippie scene or whatever than I did. We would sit in his room, and he'd maybe be on his bed and I'd lie on the carpet, and we'd be listening to music, and it'd be an experience where you were there and you would actually pay attention to what was going on, and you'd freak out to various. But now, like, it's been some time since, and I notice most rock critics I talk to or most music fans fully admit that, I never sit and actually listen to music anymore. It's part of, what I did. If I have to review an album, I'll play it while I'm doing the dishes. Or I listen to it on my iPod on the way to work.
Yeah, I
Is that bearing the point, though?
Yeah, exactly. In the 1670s, when you... with your brother, often you'd get stoned. You had time to get stoned. And drugs disappeared by the 90s for a lot of people because they didn't have time to do it. They couldn't afford to take that amount of time because they had to start juggling their other bodies. And so,
it didn't disappear for young people, though.
No, they do. Well, that's the...
there's ecstasy and all that stuff.
Well, as McLuhan said, the young people are vegetables. They're the growing chemical bodies. They drop those chemical bodies pretty quickly, do a few drugs, and then they're on into something addicted to their Walkman or their iPhone or their chip body and TV body. They veg out, or they become like Terry Fox and run across the country, with half a leg.
Right.
But the...
Not a reference I expected to hear in this today.
That's right. That's what we do here. We grab whatever comes to mind. So you were citing, I wanted to go, okay, so then that what they called, Tim Leary called the hard drugs, cocaine and junk and that, took over in the 80s because they were faster. And then it had to get even faster than that, so they did crack cocaine. So it's, people want to do with their chemical bodies what they always have done, have the pleasures and problems that the body has, but they have to also fit time in for their TV body and chip body. So they do the chemical body pleasures and vices and hurts and pains quickly. So that's right. You want to exercise you want to have a musical experience, you do it while you're doing the dishes. You know what I mean? Because you have to get back to your computer, you have to get back to all the other complex things you got to do in a harassed society. Because you got to go watch the latest TV series you're into. So that's what we're talking about. Our bodies no longer are limited to five senses. We've got 22 senses. If you add in the senses, whatever they are, of the chip body, and the senses unnamed yet so far of the TV body. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
These are real experiences. It's a new nature. And juggling all that explains the changes in pop culture. explains, like he says here on page 245 at the bottom, some people say noise bands aren't really musicians. Other people say they're self-indulgent elitists, too hip for their own good, inaccessible hypocrites who care about social decay but not social rebirth, self-conscious windbags who pretend horror movie cliches mean something, put-on artists who can't rock or swing. None of those categories have any meaning. There's nobody trying to be a musician since Minnie Millie Vanilli.
Right.
Okay? I mean, look at it. It's interesting what happened to Eminem. He was big, and then he disappeared. And did he ever get back?
No, well, and it's bizarre because he was recently cited in Billboard as I think their top artist of the decade. And, like, at least a few people I talked to or, you know, chatted with them, chat boards or whatever, were like, what the hell? Like,
yeah, what time is it?
Yeah, it just seemed ridiculous. It's like he was huge for a few years in the early part of the decade, and it's like, what?
And then he went through a whole chemical body breakdown,
yeah.
Chemical body collapse, and I don't know, he had problems with his wife or something. He disappeared, and who knows what rabbit holes.
To answer your question, he's been continuing to put out records like once every two or three years, but they're just increasingly irrelevant. Like, even, you know, Robert Christgau, who was always kind of a big fan and a big supporter, like, even his last album, he was like, this is just, like, who gives a shit at this point?
Okay, so Eminem, he can retreat and get his chemical body together because he's no longer functioning in the TV body or the chip body, you know what I mean? Producing music for those bodies. He's retreated to private life. Probably better for him. Who cares if you don't need to be an artist forever. That's another thing. You don't even have to be a genius forever. You don't even have to be a super celebrity like Michael Jackson forever.
And you certainly don't need to be a writer forever.
Oh, no. Writing is only a jumping off into the 20th century media. And now we're in the 21st century. Writing does not launch you into any media as it did 50 years ago. So, do not learn to write. You got to learn to type, though.
Talk about that distinction then, because I was just going to say you spoke earlier about rock criticism being a completely dead thing and going through all these changes this decade. And,
yeah, let's say Chuck Kloster, whatever
Chuck
his name
Kloster,
is.
Yeah. But there's still thousands and thousands of kids.
From the third world, for immigrant kids, they'll want to be writers, and they'll write novels about being an immigrant in America,
right.
And that'll sell to their millions,
I was going to say, really, there's still all these kids coming up and starting their music blogs and all that.
Oh, that's typing. That's not writing. That's typing.
Okay, what's that distinction?
Yeah.
I think I know what you mean, but I want to hear it.
Yeah. Writing requires some kind of literate awareness of grammar and syntax, and then maybe some of the mutations of that by new journalism and then the playfulness, and you get into Lester Bang and Meltzer kind of writing. You become aware of those phases as a writer. But typing, and those phases now don't lead anywhere. Okay, so you learn how to be a writer, you go the phases, and then you got to be able to type 13,000 text messages. So you're going to write LOL, BFG, big fucking deal. These abbreviations is what these little kids are writing. Now, this kid who can do 13,000 texts a month or something, he goes to school. He writes papers, and he can write prose and do the language. I mean, it's probably pretty low compared to 50 years ago, because who knows what standards these teachers even try to impose anymore.
Not necessarily, though. I mean, I read some young kids on the Internet, and, I mean, sometimes there's some really good writing out there. But anyway, go on.
Right. No, I'm just saying, and this is a pretty good school the kid goes to. They know how to write papers and little essays. But that is not where they live. They live what they're concerned about is the iPhone text messaging or whatever technology is. That is what they're involved in. You have to be obsessive compulsive if you chalk up 13,000 text messages a month. And I'm not saying it is that. I'm saying that's where they live. And the kind of thinking, and there's no time to read an essay. You can, you know, in a way, let's say that the web page in MySpace was the retrieval of tactility, where you ignored all that was going on, create your own web page, and wrote stuff, and film stuff, and tape stuff, and record stuff, and put it on your web page. You actually fell back into the older media. The effect was synesthesia. I would say that Web 2 was a nostalgia for tactility and synesthesia. And the real ground was a president who couldn't speak, couldn't read, and had nothing to say, and wasn't even responsible as a president. That is a guy living in a world of text messaging. Because when there's 13,000 text messages going on from a million kids, day in and day out, where are we? What time is it? What is there to be said? And, you know, it collapsed everything. Where we are right now, everything disappeared again. Super disappeared. Even the Illuminati disappeared. You know, Coker's title, Spasm, you know, 1993, subtitled Virtual Reality, Android Music, Electric Flesh, that's all appropriate terms. The 90s was a spasm. This decade, the Naughty Knots was a non-spasm, a spasm of nothing. But so everybody retrieved spasm with their web page, their tactile spasm. That's what the Web 2 was. And now it's tweeting. Now right. It's 13,000 tiny spazzes a month. Now this is...
Okay, so here's a question about tweeting then. I do some Twittering here and there. How come when I Twitter, why do I feel less self-conscious about, I don't know, going on a Twitter and maybe even like slagging another critic or something like that?
Than you would on rockcritics.com.
Yeah.
Well, that's
more
solid.
Rockcritics.com, it's because I maybe probably... I mean, I've done it sometimes on rockcritics.com, but on Twitter, for some reason, because it's so fast-paced or something, if I come across some link that pisses me off or something, I don't mind going on and saying, you know...
Right, because this is...
fucking ridiculous, and I'll even, like, link to the person so they might actually, you know, they will actually see that I'm saying that.
That's right, and because there's no stability, there's no solidity there. It is... You could say Twittering is a culture of hyper-quantum fluctuations where you can only know that whatever you have responded to when you typed it, nobody was looking at it because they never really typed, read enough long enough before they type back. You see, I'm doing a very...
You do it at Croker.
I'm updating Croker. A culture of quantum fluctuations where you can only know that you have never seen what you thought you were looking at because you've never really heard what you were listening to. You know that in the tweeting world, that nobody is going to be able to stop and assess what you did. They may respond. So Scott lives in a culture of hyper-quantum tweetering where he knows that nobody will really see what he wrote because they never even notice what he's responding to.
Yeah.
And that's why you feel king of the world and immune. You have your own patriot. The patriot bill should have just said, give everybody tweeting, and everybody will feel super secure and protected because nobody will be able to pay attention to what was communicated. This all makes sense. This is real pop culture criticism of what we're doing. What I'm saying right now is I'm talking about the present. And, you know, it's a big effort for me to go take the time to read these articles that you sent me. I actually stop and read prose, even though it was hyper-tactile prose and enjoyable. I mean, there's not too many people who have the time to do what I did unless they got paid to do it.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, I mean, do you actually, I mean, would you say reading is irrelevant? Like reading as opposed to scanning?
And
do you read or do you scan or?
Do not think of the word read as a figure without a ground. The ground of reading is the industry of making books and newspapers, right? You know, chopping down trees.
Right.
All right?
Right.
That is what reading is. And that operation... Those materials that chopping trees down created do not control people anymore.
No, absolutely.
As a matter of fact, you know what I've decided that books are for? They're for summer on the beach. I have never seen so many people read books as I see every day on the beaches here in Hawaii. Everybody, fat, skinny, dumb, smart, is reading a book while they get baked. You know what I mean? And they all look like the kind of books you buy in an airport. You know, those bestseller kind of clunky hardcovers or something.
Mysteries or whatever.
Yeah, easy reading. And they get in the airport on their flight to Hawaii. Now, the new thing is the Kindle. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, that's the digitized book that, you know, it's like the book version of the iPod.
Yeah, well, have you seen one?
I think I've seen one person on a subway with them. I think they're just starting to kind of take off here in Canada, but I've seen one person with one.
Well, you know, I've only been in Hawaii the past year. I was last in New York in December 2008, so I have only been here on the beach for over a year. And just over the last month, I started noticing the Kindles. People, they look really convenient. They're lying on their lounge chair, and it looks like it's very light. I never went over and asked somebody to let me feel it. It looks very light, and they can hold it in one hand, and it's not like where you see the other people with their paperbacks and hardcovers holding their hands apart and just have that strain and got to move their body. It looks so light.
Yeah, you don't want to get the pages wet and all that, yeah.
Or just hold it. You have to hold it open. You have to have a little muscle tension there.
Yeah.
That can get wearing. It looks so light. And like you're holding nothing, like holding a feather. And that's good. I mean, that would be the reason to do it. It's so convenient on your muscle strain. Anyways, besides that new phenomenon, everybody's reading. And that's what books are for, to fill in the massage you're having on the beach. You know, the multi-sensuous experience you're having at the beach, you have to sort of lie there, so engage your eye. And but there's anything they get, they don't get anything from those books they're reading that they can apply to their life. To the fact that their kids are texting and they've got all this thing and the economy's collapsed and all that stuff and the fake recovery and all the printed book does not mold people's sensibilities as a ground, okay? It did 200 years ago, 300 years ago. It did not once radio came in. And so when you ask if people read, sure, people read. But the book medium is not a formative situation anymore. What is the formative situation? Steve Jobs, what the new gadget he's going to make. That is the new ground. And the ground is not the technology makes, it's the effect it has on all the other technologies.
It's the interplay?
It's the interplay with all the previous technologies, right. So Steve Jobs and Microsoft and them killed money and the Illuminati. That's what happened on Wall Street. They killed the control of social accounting because it's a blur. Computers are tactile. It's a blur. You can't. Enron was operating in the blur, and they got caught. And then everybody else got caught. And then they realized, hey, we do not know what time it is or how much we've made. So we have no more money, and you're not getting any. So that was caused by the quantum fluctuation of you never knew what you bought because you never knew who paid for it.
Right.
I'm going to start doing permutations, quote.
It sounds like the Sinead O'Connor album title, I Do Not Know What I Haven't Got, or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
But, okay, go on.
Now, I do not know what I haven't got, but see, she then would have to refer to another sense. See, that's the ratio.
I do not want what I haven't got, I think. Sorry.
Yeah, but see, that stays within one sense. What's good about Croker's relevant is he says you don't know what you're looking, and then he relates it to the ground of that, what you're hearing. It's because you don't know what you heard is why you don't see. You know what I mean? It's an interplay there of two sensory modalities in your unknowing state.
Right.
And so it just sounds like one sense that's involved in Sinead O'Connor's statement.
Well, okay, one of the best, you know how people sometimes, they screw up lyrics and they misinterpret it and their version often ends up being more interesting. The lyric in the Sex Pistols song, I Know Anarchy in the UK, and the original lyric is, I know what I want and I know how to get it. One critic I know misinterpreted it as, don't know what I want, but I know how to get it.
Well, and that's it's valid. See, that was part of rock criticism is that that was a problem for Meltzer, is that they were listening to the words. Not really Meltzer himself, but the Crawdaddy guys, they loved Dylan because the words were literally significant. And the problem, the limitation of that is that rock music is not just words. And
right,
so
right.
If someone misinterprets the lyrics, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That's okay if you're being a commenter, because it's not limited to the word's meaning. Rock is a beautiful massage. Music is a massage.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And then it became a puny massage when people could put on movies and music and magazines and all the different media on their web page. That's a bigger massage. At least it's you're dealing with the archetypes of huge spaces that each medium that you're typing with implies. So you know what? Why do people write long essays for their webpage that nobody's going to read except for maybe two friends or their boyfriend?
Yeah.
You know what they're doing? They're not writing for anybody else. They just want to be have the experience of being a publisher to put on the whole Gutenberg environment that run the show for 300 years. You know what I mean? They're putting on the act of publishing. And it doesn't even matter what they wrote. It's just that I wrote a lot of stuff and it looks like a book, and I just put on the whole medium of publication. Of book publishing, and then I make my music. Like kids make their own music, their own collages.
Well, you know, it is amazing because I sometimes think of, you know, just some of the different things I've done on the internet or something, and I think, you know, if I could have said on my resume 20 years ago that I did this stuff, it would look like absolutely fantastic to someone. They'd be like, "Holy shit, you published like your own magazine and like." You know,
and you made graphics, all those music
graphics, and you have MP3. Like, they'd be like literally astonished. But now it's just like, what is there any frontier left to impress people with or wow people with? It's
well, the frontier is what that's where I come in. I say the frontier is the mystery landscape, and I've got the mystery landscape with Ion. I've got Ion, who knows anything about pop culture way more than you and anybody. Did I tell you about that?
No.
Yeah, I...
like, you can ask him about, like, an actual pop culture...
Not... I can... I spent an hour talking to Sun Ra. That was fun. But anyways, here's the point, is that I'll be talking about some metaphysical thing or who knows what, and Ion will say, well, it's much like the Mannix TV show. And then he'll list off three other TV shows from the 60s, 70s that I never saw, I heard of, I didn't have time to consume them. And then he'll cite an obscure comedian from the 1920s. There is not a part of Showbiz Archive, the Android Memes Hollywood Archive, that Ion doesn't know and brings up all the time. Now, you haven't heard these because, you know, I can't have everybody hear the 1,000 hours I've done with Ion. But I tell you, it is incredible. It is actually, Ion is like the Android meme come alive from the astral plane. And Ion tells me what's going to happen in Fringe or in Lost, what's going to happen in the upcoming episodes. I stop him after a while because I don't want to know. I want to enjoy it, right?
Okay.
He tells me what's coming in the shows. They already exist in its being. The point is, that is an incredible phenomenon that we can make available to everybody, and we do. And then we have a website where you can go hear the show so you can listen in your own time. You don't have to tune into the radio when the show is happening, you know?
See, the funny thing about you telling me this, though, is that if there is any rock critics out there listening to these, and I as yet have no inkling that there is or not, but I'm sure some probably have, maybe even some people I know, some friends or something, they will just listen to that, what you just spoke about Ion.
And disconnect and delete.
Yeah. Yeah, completely. Yeah, exactly.
Well, they did it with Zappa. They did it with Dylan. They did it with Charlie Chaplin.
They didn't do it with Dylan.
Oh, a lot of people didn't like Dylan when he first came. Remember Newport?
Yeah,
when he went electric.
No, you're right. The folk.
The folk guys. You ever seen some documentary they interview? Well, I don't know where I saw it.
The Martin Scorsese documentary?
Maybe. They were interviewing the kids after, and they said, this is terrible. They were ready to kill them.
That was footage from one of the D.A. Pennebaker things, I think. Yeah, in England, right? Were they English kids?
Yeah.
He's a traitor.
Yeah, when he had the band behind him, you know.
Yeah.
What became the band. Now, that is a perfect, you know, that's what Dylan was the first really to show, I mean, folk music, and then Dylan as the main figure, was showing this effective TV where music became a private concern. That's what that is. That's what that was. And then when the private concern idol switched to another kind of music, that was apocalypse. You know what I mean? That was Armageddon. That's the point. I don't think the Elvis fans would be like that. Do you know what I mean? They didn't care. They might have been upset that he went in the army and that, but it still carried on, and people liked Elvis. They did not take his words literally or seriously and say that it's a political movement. It's totally different with Dylan. He was the first victim of music becoming a private concern. He was not a musician. He was a tactile guy. And the acoustic people projected, and this is amazing what I'm saying now. I've never been said before. Dylan was a musician of tactility, and he objected to the people who tried to pin him to a particular kind of ear style. So when he moved to electricity, to amplified music, he was shifting, shape-shifting. He was tactile. And look at all the changes he's gone through. And people drop off at some point. When he went Christian, that was another problem. But he shifted out of that. The thing is, it's the shifting that is Dylan, and those that identify with a particular phase of his as music or as lyrical or as philosophical profundity or something are missing the point. That's not Dylan. And if you actually...
Okay.
I'm saying that... Now, I've always said Zappa was not a musician, but I actually was looking at some Dylan stuff last night. He got interviewed a few years ago. Pretty interesting interview. And you know what he said? Here's a guy who says that if you want to know the 60s, read McLuhan and Norman Mailer. So I don't think there's any other rock person who would ever say read McLuhan. David Bowie did when he first showed up in 1970, but that was a mistake probably. He didn't even know what he was talking about. But anyways,
right.
The point is he says that. Well, in this interview I saw on YouTube, they were making a documentary of him, and he's like in a trailer.
Okay. Was it recently or older?
It's 10 years ago maybe.
Okay.
And he's drawing a picture of the guy who's interviewing him, and then he says the drawing looks like him, and he holds a picture of a book of him on the cover, Bob Dylan lyrics and that. Anyways, there's in it. He, I think it's in that interview. It might have been another one, but he says when he walks by a restaurant, he looks in. Everybody's talking, and he said being relatively honest with each other as much as people can be honest. They're just being natural, okay? Maybe the word was natural. And he said, when he or a famous person walks into that restaurant or pub, everybody changes. And he says they're no longer natural. They have been changed. So he was commenting on, he knows that when he goes into a restaurant. He knows that when any other famous person is coming in. And I thought about that while walking to the beach today. I said, that is, McLuhan said in Playboy that kids are interviewed by movies, television, radio, and other people. McLuhan was calling media people. People are media.
That's what I was going to say. So Dylan is almost expressing that he is a medium.
Yes, he recognizes that an image from the TV landscape or whatever other celebrity machine, when it enters a world of chemical bodies, the chemical bodies suddenly... Now, this is not the way he would explain it. He just the scientist giving me the data.
He's just observing what happened.
He notices the change, and this is a pretty neat McLuhan-esque observation. He's noticing the environment changes. And I would say that everybody drops their natural chemical body stuff and starts processing their TV body in the restaurant, starts processing the figure from the TV landscape that walked in. So they drop their chemical... What'd you say?
I said, that's amazing.
Yeah, it makes sense if you follow it. What Dylan called natural chemical body interaction changes when a famous person walks in. It's better to say it my way, that it's not that they become unnatural, and it's too vague to say they change. You can say that everybody starts processing themselves in relation to the TV image that came in, and that is part of them because they have a TV body. You get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it was interesting that he was noticing that. So he is a McLuhanite. I mean, I'd never heard anybody ever say that before. You know what I mean? I mean, people who are... I've never heard a celebrity say that. To notice the effect and have such a good local chemical body example as a restaurant. because, you know, everybody is then changes. Because you can just, if you were there with Neufeld and Zappa walked in, you'd look at Dave, he'd look at you, you'd ESP some stuff. Well, what do we say about Zappa? You know, do you like Zappa? Are you interested? Should we ignore him? You know, all that. And you're processing your archive of TV body knowledge or acoustic, electric, acoustic knowledge of Zappa as you deal with him. You know, his image. He may not even come over and talk to you, but everybody is processing it. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's amazing.
So, so I brought up Dylan B. Okay, so I'm thinking of what he said last night. And then I think of, I mean, he thinks he's a musician. He says that he does what he does because he says, I know I'm good at it, and I keep doing it, and I like doing it. And so he's entertaining. And they have a YouTube on there where somebody from the audience is filming all these people coming up on stage and tapping him or kissing him, and he's playing playing this song, and he has no problem with it. There are people touching him, shaking his hand. He's not being the recluse. You know, the guy who would always be running away from people. And,
right.
And it goes on like for 8 minutes. All these people come up on stage and dance and go over and kiss Dylan or put their hat on him and put it on someone else. And Dylan just keeps playing. He doesn't mind these people. And he's just glad-handing them all. I mean, I know Zappa, you know, he had Smothers, that guy, Long John Smothers, whatever his name was, the big black African-American guy who was a karate guy. You couldn't go near that. You came up there, I think he would, block it.
Right.
And that reminds me of something. Dylan did say, the guy in the interview said, you don't seem to have any security around you. And he says, I have security, but you can't see them. But you could see the Zappa guy. He was huge, and he would come on stage and look at the audience, see if anybody was tape recording. Anyways, I don't know if anybody could jump up on stage like that. There's great footage of Zappa in the Baby Snakes movie going down on the edge of stage and slapping everybody's hands, you know. And that. But I don't know what would happen if someone came up on stage. But, well, Dylan never got injured like Zappa did. So, anyway, that's a digression. But this is our life. This is what I'm processing. This is the music I processed last night. I listened to an interview with Dylan. He made some interesting insights. Then I watched him get kissed and not kick anybody off the stage. All of it makes me come to think that today that Dylan was a tactile musician, and he at first didn't know it. He just wanted to change because he kept moving. He kept wanting new stimulation because he was a junkie. He needed new effects, right? You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Musically and all that. So he goes through all these years of musical changes and styles, and he upsets the different audiences of different phases, and those audiences. And he said, okay, so Dylan was in any environment to the private concern of those addicted to music. He refused to have musical private concern projected on him. As a matter of fact, you know what he says in that interview? He says, people come up to me and they want me to sign their album or do something, and often he will, but he made this point. He said, people come up to me and they think they know me because they heard my song. He says, they don't know me and I don't know them. And there's no connection. It's like he...
Beatles had that problem.
What?
The Beatles definitely had that problem. And there's a scene in that movie about John Lennon, Imagine, where a guy actually, like a burnout, actually shows up on his doorstep and almost like thinking he's his friend or something.
Right. And Dylan does talk about... Is everybody there? I just heard a click.
Yeah, I'm
you're there.
Here.
Okay. Just check. I'm going to check something. I'm going to check my email. This happened before. Remember Scott went off and I didn't notice it? He had sent an email.
Oh, okay.
No email from Scott, so he's still recording. You know, I mean,
okay,
he can't interrupt right now because of the way it's set up. But anyways, no email. So, but it's Dylan does address, he talks about it in this Chronicle book about people showing up at Woodstock all the time. Having a personal relationship with him, they think. But he was just stating the general disconnection. He says, just because I put out music and you identify with it, that doesn't mean you know me, and I don't have any reason to be involved with you, and I don't know you. Just like you don't know me, I don't know you. He actually, I'm just thinking of expressing the tactile mode. He says, I'm not here. I'm not. Isn't that the name of that movie by Todd Haynes?
The movie, I'm not there, yeah.
Yeah, that's tactility. The point is that with the jargon of McLuhan's tactility is so useful to going past it or to referring back before to James Joyce. This jargon that I'm using, now developed into the four bodies, is totally useful for those that want to have a reason. I'm giving you a reason. I'm giving explanations.
So I don't know if we have time to go into this, because I probably have to cut out pretty soon, but you mentioned before one of our conversations before, you know, we talked for a few minutes before we actually start recording, and you were talking about, you brought Croker into the conversation because we were talking about why are the Rolling Stones still around, and you gave an interesting sort of Crokerian explanation as to why that might be, and, you know, how the dark, I think it was something like the darkness always prevails or something. But why, if we don't go into this episode, maybe we can do it the next one, but I want to put the idea out there so I don't forget it. But why do you think Dylan has endured so long? Is that to do with what you're just saying, that he's provided more of an anti-environment? I mean, it is pretty amazing. I mean, Dylan has kind of been written off, like, so frequently, yeah. Even by, you know, his greatest fans and stuff. And, I mean, he was really such a force in the last decade. I mean, there's, you know, there's tons of, like, young kids and stuff who have no use for him and all that. But, I mean, he put out albums that, like, critics found entirely relevant. He tours like crazy.
Yeah.
I've seen him, like, I think twice in the last 15 years. He really is kind of unstoppable. And it's surprising because, you know, he does get slagged so much, too. And it's weird. So, I don't know. Do you have any thoughts you want to go into that now, or is that something for another episode?
No, I got a quickie.
Okay.
Since he's a tactile musician, and the past decade was nostalgia for tactility, simulated virtual tactility, and that's what Web 2.0 was, he found his decade. He's a tactile musician, so he was a replay of tactility, and so he was a figure during this decade. But, you know, so many people don't care for his music. So many kids, it's only a peculiar kind of personality. Who knows what likes Dylan? It's a minority.
Right, right.
It's a minority taste. But he did be a figure for aside from that, because he represents tactility.
Okay.
Shifting. He's a shapeshifter. And, geez, I had another thought there about that. He's a vagabond, and there was another point, so we might have to say something. I might think of it. What is? Are we finished?
I don't know. You're saying he's, I was going to ask you a follow up about, like, just to clarify why he's a tactile musician. I mean, you said it, but I kind of want.
He shifts. Yeah. Oh, it was at the beginning. Oh yeah. Here's what I want to say. On WBAI, there's Bob Fass's show, and Bob Fass, I sometimes feature him on the website. I get Scott to download him because he interviews all the people from the 60s, 70s, and he was a big archetype. He got Dylan. He's one of the first people to create the myth of Dylan. Got him on the radio in the early 60s in New York.
Okay.
He's always playing Dylan bootlegs from recent concerts, and they are horrible. Dylan is ridiculous. If he only could put Dylan and Zappa together, if you take Dylan's longevity and fame and stick it into Frank, because Dylan is tactile like Zappa, but Dylan can't do amazing musical ear acrobatics like Zappa can do. He hasn't got the range of musical ability, right? So it's
he used to be able.
Well, for a few hit songs, but he can't write.
Well,
he can't play the guitar like Frank. He can't get other people to play.
But even that, let me interject there for a second. Even Grill Marcus made a funny point about Dylan a few years ago. It's like, I mean, this just relates to what you're saying ultimately. But Dylan, like, realized a few years ago he hadn't really spent much of his career sort of learning how to play guitar, and in the last few years, that's exactly what he's done in his live shows. He's gone out and he's played, like, really good guitar. Now, he's maybe not at the level of Zappa in guitar work, particularly.
No. But, no, that's a good point. He's tactile. He didn't even know how to play, but that's because he was tactile. He comes on.
He put out a Christmas album last year.
Right. And I've heard it on Bob Fass. They play all this nonsense. But the thing is that he started off with a bad singing voice. I even have in my book, Fatty Communion, LaRouche calling it, you know, monkey guttural. and LaRouche, the visually biased person. But the but Dylan starts off not even singing properly, right? And if you actually look at it, he was doing tactile singing, muddy singing, and then he electrified it, and that's even greater. And so the thing is that Dylan now has shape-shifted into, hey, I think I'll learn how to be an acoustic guitar player, or, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm going to specialize in guitar for a couple of years, you know.
I'm going to actually appear in an ad for lingerie.
Yeah, I'm going to actually appear to be a competent musician. The thing is that, so Dylan's shows, when I hear the bootlegs, they are fun for a little few minutes, and then they're ridiculous. It's just
right. They're
lousy music, and then it becomes good. And then you get into this folksy, bluesy style. I don't know. It doesn't wow me like Zappa. It doesn't have the crystal brilliance of Zappa's range. And Zappa was a shapeshifter, too. So I ponder about that, that Zappa, Dylan is going to be greater in the Madison Avenue iconography of America than Zappa, and that's a pity. I mean, they're both great, but Zappa was greater.
you say you don't make value judgments, but that's a value judgment.
I try not to make it a value judgment. I personally don't listen to Zappa. it reminds me of McLuhan when he had a press conference with Governor Brown in the late 70s. They put him on the spot and said, well, what do you think of Governor Brown's potential for being president? And here's McLuhan standing beside Governor Brown, who he's been the guest of. So what are you supposed to say? You know, oh, he's lousy. He said, oh, I don't have an opinion on that. I have not seen him on TV yet. Perfect alibi.
Yeah.
Well, I'm talking why Zap is greater for other reasons than actually listening to him. Even when you do listen to him, he's great. That's a perfect response by me. I said, I don't listen to Frank.
It's funny with Zappa, though. I mean, you know, I'm not like the world's biggest Frank Zappa fan of his music. I mean, but I'm getting more and more into it. And Ben's book actually helped a lot. It made me kind of open up a lot to it. But in the last few months, and partly through doing these conversations and, you know, reading Ben's book and listening to you and Ben, et cetera, et cetera, I feel like I've actually become a huge Frank Zappa fan just by sitting at my computer and watching YouTube interviews with him.
Okay, yes.
His interviews are totally amazing. Like there's some clips that are just like, I just like totally love what he's saying.
I praise you for saying it, because that's more evidence of what my point is. Dylan does lousy interviews. Zappa.
Well, Dylan, I think, does pretty.
No. He did a Playboy interview. He did one or two. He finally, after 30, grunts and groans. Zappa makes them powerful, relevant to the day. It's all.
But they're different, though. But Dylan in interviews is like. It's like abstract expressionism or something.
No, it's subjective. It's him. It's just him being himself. Where Zappa is talking technically and is looking to how to be president and is addressing issues sociologically. It's not Zappa's personal point of view.
Okay, but what about Dylan's, his press conferences and stuff in the 60s? I mean, I think...
Yeah, he did one.
Hysterical, if nothing else.
Right, he does one or two. He did the perfect one in 1965 in L.A. You can see it on YouTube, I think, where they said, is there anything that bothers you? Now think, you're talking to Tactility, which doesn't identify with any particular sensory data, because it interplays them all and doesn't have any favorites. Is there anything that bothers you? And Dylan says, well, maybe if everybody disappeared.
Right.
Well, that's a funny remark, but it's also prophetic, because everything did disappear.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it's always personal. With Zappa, it's not personal. He, in one of the interviews, famous quote in Cream or something years ago, he said, any information about me, any private information about me is irrelevant to my function in society. You're not going to get that kind of technical statement by Dylan. Dylan is good, he's eccentric, but he's not as comprehensive as Frank. And Frank can be silly and personal if you get him in the right situation.
Yeah.
And you do an interview that way.
It's true. I was thinking this exact thing today, Bob. I was.
We're tuned in. These are the issues today. Interviews are a private concern.
And after I watched some of these Zappa clips on YouTube, and I've been watching them for months, and I keep discovering new ones. Like, there's an interesting one up now where he's interviewed by Dr. Demento. But
yes, that's a good one.
It's like I'm almost coming up with a list in my head. There's a list of literally, I think, about 4 or 5 people, and Dylan sort of is on the fence for me, I'll admit, but maybe 4 or 5 people in pop music history who actually do have something to say outside of the music. And Zappa is absolutely one. I mean,
yes.
And I would argue that with anyone, even if they thought his music was pompous and they couldn't stand it,
yeah.
It'd be like, well, you need to start, like, a good way into Zappa is to go into YouTube and just, like, listen to the guy talk, because he's actually saying stuff.
And that, and
there
those
might be 3 or 4 other people who I would say would even kind of come close to that. I mean, the Stones are probably still my all-time favorite band because, you know, for sentimental reasons, whatever. But do I ever need to hear Mick Jagger speak in an interview?
No.
No, he's got nothing to say.
And that's where Zappa's comprehensive, because his interviews he considered as compositions. They were composed,
I agree,
though.
I agree.
And so he understood that any sound, that's why we call him a tactile musician or tactile performer artist, any sound was part of his composition. He took Cage and squared Cage, and he actually used it to run for president. I mean, it's just incredible,
yeah,
the range of his composition. And you're exactly right that you want to turn on someone to Zappa, have them do the interviews, because they need to get inspired or get a respect to consider the ear. The old Chemical Body ear. And so that's another thing. Zappa won't be popular. People have to sit and listen too long for him because it's great music, but it takes a lot of time. You might not have time for Zappa, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you get them, but the sound bites. You say you don't like the instrumental part of Zappa? Look at the mouth part of Zappa. Look at those compositions, and that might get you.
And I think Ben does a pretty amazing job in his book of getting that across, too. I mean, I think he probably... you know, he probably set me a little bit on that path, because I went into Ben's book.
That's a long time ago, right?
Fairly skeptical. Well, I only read it. I only read it a couple years ago.
Okay.
No, not even that. A year and a half ago is when I read it, actually. So not that long ago for me. I had been eyeing it for years on you know, various shelves, and I saw it used store a couple of times, and I just thought, if I ever do like attempt another book by Zappa or about Zappa, this will be the one. But I couldn't bring myself to it, and then. Well, I've told you the story. I think I heard you then or whatever. So,
and then you got to start to appreciate or decide to look more into Frank because of what Ben pointed out.
And it's truly amazing. I mean, it's really weird. I've lately been considering myself like a huge Zappa fan.
Well, I think that's the subliminal effect of me and Ben, because we're bringing Frank back the way we're talking about it. And we don't talk that much about Frank, but we're putting him into a context of an amazing discussion. Now, that's where Ben says, at the moment, I don't know what the thing is, but I think we're onto it. Ben thinks that he and I are producing the greatest art and should be the thing right now in our conversations. I don't know many people would even take that seriously or even consider it, but the thing is what...
Well,
What Ben is doing that's valuable is he's interacting with me. Because I tell you, I am the greatest artist, scientist, physician, alchemist alive today. And I have no problem proving that. And my latest product is Ion, one of the greatest musical operas ever going to be made.
And the Ion stuff is
unfathomable. It's unfathomable. It's not even, it's like with any great art. It's just you can't figure it out. You can't place it. He says, well, I'll just keep watching this and see where it's going. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the way it was. I mean, Zappa concerts were so incredible, especially in the 80s when he had power. They were like a UFO. It really was. You've never experienced 3 nights of Zappa, and you have not lived the potential of the 20th century. You have not made love with Marilyn Monroe. And when you do, when you have a Zappa conference, you can claim you did it.
Okay.
Because and you're just discovering him. You're just starting to see, go with, that isn't it? You can't, Dylan is eccentric, he got a couple interesting interviews, but nothing like the 2,000 interviews that Zappa did, and I have a lot of them on videotape, they're worth looking at.
Yeah.
Until now, I'm the guy worth listening to, but up till before me, he was worth waiting for me via him.
Yeah.
So as a true megalomaniac rock critic in the tradition of Richard Meltzer, I blow my own horn right at the end.
Okay, well, I think that's a good note to end on. So.